Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Shakespeare's in fashion once again, as a steady stream of films like the Academy Award-winning Shakespeare in Love, along with new dramatic productions of his plays, are luring people back into the theaters. But just who was this most famous dramatist of all time, the private person by whom we've read so much but know so little? We explore the life of Shakespeare in today's show with the help of one of his leading biographers, Park Conen. But first, let's look back at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week in 1928, the Pact of Paris was signed by French Foreign Minister Aristide Briand and the United States Secretary of State, Frank Kellogg. The Kellogg-Briand Peace Pact that would outlaw war stipulated that no signing nation could use war as a means to solving international disputes. Conceived by America and France in reaction to the catastrophic effects of World War I, the pact was signed by 64 nations, but it was difficult to enforce, and over the course of the next decade, Italy, Japan, and Germany, all signers of the pact, invaded other countries, leading to World War II. After the war, the Allied powers used the principles of the Kellogg-Briand Pact to build a legal foundation for the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, one family with historic ties to the site of the decisive Civil War battle is having a skirmish of its own with the federal government. Angela Rosensteel Eckert, whose family once owned part of the land on which the battle was fought, and who over the years donated more than 38,000 Civil War antiques and collectibles to the Gettysburg National Military Park, are now claiming that the U.S. government has failed to adequately protect and preserve the artifacts. They also oppose construction of a $27 million museum that would be built on the battlefield, ground the family considers sacred. Archaeologists spent 5 years excavating an ancient site at an oasis 200 miles southwest of Cairo, Egypt, before an unknowing donkey sunk into the treasure for which they had been searching. The site, a necropolis from the Greco-Roman era with about 10,000 graves, offers researchers an in-depth view of mummification and religious practices when the site was home to roughly 500,000 people. You're listening to Talking History. It seems that once the deadest of all dead white males is very much alive again, he's been resurrected by a steady stream of cultural fare, most notably the Academy Award-winning film Shakespeare in Love. Clearly, Western literature owes a great deal to this man, about whom we know precious little. Well, maybe we can rectify the situation at least a little today by welcoming to our show Park Conen, the author of a biography of William Shakespeare, much praised by critics for being impressively and thoroughly researched. Mr. Conen is Emeritus Professor of English at the University of Leeds, and he speaks to us today from his home in the north of England. Welcome, Professor Conen, and thank you for joining us.
It's very nice to be with you by virtue of the radio and telephone lines.
Right. Professor, why is it we know so little about a man who wrote so much?
Well, really, we're going 400 years back. Shakespeare did not have a royal position. He was simply a writer for a public acting company. In fact, we're learning more and more and more about him, largely because of the great new interest in local studies, especially in England. If I may say briefly, I was certainly helped at the Folger Library in Washington, the Huntington in California, the Newbery in Chicago. But over here, the Warwickshire local record office in Stratford was immensely helpful. Lots of new material has come up. Also, the Edinburgh University Library, the Lancashire record office, the Worcester record office are all getting the results of this new interest in local studies, and many new things are turning up about Shakespeare.
Is it that the local studies provides context, or does it give us direct information about Shakespeare?
Both. Absolutely both. We found out new things about him at Worcester and at the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust Records Office in Stratford, for example, and incidentally also at the Folger in Washington. But also, context helps us to interpret what we already know and flesh that out.
When and where was Shakespeare born and raised? Tell us about his family a bit.
Well, he was the first child to live in the family of a very prominent, well-liked local man in Stratford-upon-Avon in the center of England in Warwickshire. He was born in April 1564. His father, a year or two later, was elected mayor of the city, or town, I should say. He were only in office for 1 year. But after that, the father came to grief because he'd been investing in wool illegally and lending money illegally. Shakespeare's mother was a very, very intelligent woman from a Catholic family. And so Shakespeare was probably brought up, as I've said, in the shadow of the Catholic faith, but he really conformed to the Anglican faith, as his parents had to. He's really a very privileged child at first. Even when his father falls from grace, as it were, and gets into trouble, the father was so popular, he was helped by fellow aldermen and others in the village, in the town, so that Shakespeare was not deprived as a boy, but had many advantages.
What kind of education did he receive?
Well, putting that very briefly, I would say we now know that he received about the best education that's ever been offered in England for young poets. It was absolutely phenomenal. The schools then were teaching boys the most complex rhetorical system ever invented, the Roman one, and he was learning to create an emotive voice on paper in his themes, epistles, and orations that he had to write in grammar school. He had a wonderful memory, so that he's really one of the first absolutely to master this system and to put it in practice. And we find him in the first 10 years as a playwright really learning to use that system with ever more flexibility and power. He would write, just for one example, he would write controversiae, all in Latin, incidentally, in school, taking now one side of a view of an argument and then the other side and stating them with the utmost emotional force. So you see, right from grammar school, from the age of 7, he's already been being trained as a playwright.
He married a local girl, Anne Hathaway. What was she like?
Well, Anne was a little bit older than he was. He was 18 when he made her pregnant. She was the daughter of a fairly prosperous farmer at Shottery, which is in the same area as Stratford, only a mile west of the town itself. Her father had died. Her brother had moved away, the brother she was close to, and she no doubt turned to Shakespeare because she wanted really to help someone. She felt very useful, and this is the way she remains for the rest of her life. But he put him in a rather bad position. It is far more objectionable, far more difficult than today to have an illegitimate child. The whole community came down on your head, and Shakespeare risked disgrace for himself and his family. So he got off to a rather bad start, and then at the next go, he had twins. What this meant was that in his early 20s, he was highly pressured to make money any way he could and to make money fast.
In the movie, again, Shakespeare in Love, we get the impression that Shakespeare and his wife were estranged. Is there any truth in that?
Not that we know of, no. You know, one has to get back to the times, really, to interpret the marriage well. Belief in the sacredness of marriage, the sacredness of the institution, as it were, reinforced unions. Shakespeare retired to Stratford. He saw his wife whenever he could. It doesn't mean that he was necessarily absolutely faithful to her. Sometimes I think that we're led astray by our idea of love. I don't think the Elizabethans were. You were committed to your husband or wife. You might fall in love briefly with someone else, but you remained loyal, and I think he did.
Well, let me pick up on that, this perhaps not remaining faithful. Any truth to the rumors that circulate that he had affairs with other women?
We know about one woman whom he was very close to, and this is something that a good deal of information has come to light about recently, Janet Davenant. We know about another woman, his landlady, whom he aided, and she had had adulterous affairs before, Marie Mountjoy. So it's very probable that staying away from his wife, you know, through most of the year, working in London very hard and needing some sort of relaxation and consolation, he probably did indulge in adultery for a while. The sonnet suggests that. He's absolutely paralyzed with guilt, the sonnet speaker, not that the speaker is necessarily Shakespeare, but it looks that way. Later, he becomes very close to Janet Davenant and her husband, and very helpful to his landlady. So these are two women whom he's involved with. I think by his mid-30s, Shakespeare becomes a very respectable man, and actually people turn to him for advice about love and about marriage, you know, so that his aberrations were those of a very young man.
How did he get in the theater business, Park?
I think that so far we can say it's very, very likely that he had a time in Lancashire, which is north of Warwickshire, north of Stratford, beginning as a teacher for a great family, the family of Houghton, and that after being there for a while, he joined Houghton's troupe of players. So I think it was this combination, being a very bright boy in school, being able to work for a large landowner for a while to teach that landowner's retainer's children the rudiments of English and Latin, and then drifting into an acting company in the north, and then going down south and getting into this very difficult business of the theaters with lots of competition with other actors and the big scramble. The theater was a very dangerous place at the time. Shakespeare was very good at preserving himself and slowly making his way ahead. When he is about 30, he joins a stable acting company, the Chamberlain's Men, and remains with that company for the rest of his working days. It shifted in its name. It became the King's Men, but he remains with that one company for about 20 years then.
What was his life like working in the theater in London?
Well, it involved very, and I think it's terribly interesting, this, the very extra practices in getting along with egotists. The theater was extremely dangerous. Actors lived on their feelings. They dueled off stage. There are many, many cases of actors killing each other. A playgoer is murdered for arguing over the price of admission at one theater. Shakespeare is an extremely tactful man. He cultivates a respectable, genial image. He satirizes himself in his plays. He's always putting himself down. He's getting along even with such an egotist as Ben Jonson. You know, Ben Jonson called him my beloved. This is absolutely the most wonderful man. He will listen to me, Jonson in effect is saying. So with enormous tact, probably writing his plays in the winter, in his favorite writing months, between November and February, taking minor parts in his plays and other plays the year round, and doing everything he possibly can to help his acting company. That was basically what Shakespeare's life amounted to in London.
He certainly impresses us with his wide-ranging knowledge of history in his history plays. How did he acquire this knowledge? I mean, did he simply go into a study somewhere, into a library, and dig out this information? How do we account for this?
That's a very good question. We do know that four patrons whom we can associate him with, I think the first one is problematic, but it's virtually certain, had libraries. Alexander de Houghton in Lancashire. A man who sponsored a company was Ferdinando Lord Strange, also of Lancashire, but also living in London, so Shakespeare would have had access to his library. The widow of Lord Strange leaves one of her books to a man named Wilhelmi in Latin, William someone. The last name is lost, but it could well be Shakespeare. The Earl of Southampton had a library at Titchfield in Hampshire. The Earl of Pembroke in Wiltshire. Furthermore, Shakespeare would have had access to some bookshops. Certainly that, this is a very important one, of his Stratford friend Richard Field in London. He had a printing office and what amounted to a bookshop. And we do know, we can trace one book definitely coming from Field's office. So, in other words, to be brief about it, Shakespeare would have relied on his patrons' libraries and on some of the printing offices and bookshops in London.
We only have about 2 minutes left, so let me ask you a question. You mentioned in your book that Shakespeare, the man, is surrounded by myths. Why don't you take one of those myths right now and debunk it for our listeners, if you would?
I think the myth I'd like to debunk the most, perhaps, would be that he wrote his sonnets to a dark lady, a kind of dark-haired vamp who could be a prostitute, such as Lucy Negro, who kept a bordello in Clerkenwell, or Lord Hunsdon's mistress, Amelia Lanier, or the Earl of Pembroke's mistress, Amelia, who was another woman. This is all myth. We don't know that Shakespeare met any of these people. Mary Fitton was the last name I was thinking of. The truth about Shakespeare and women is far, far more interesting than all of the myths. I mentioned his relations with Janet Davenant and Marie Mountjoy, but also those with his mother, Mary Arden, his wife, Anne Hathaway, and especially those with his somewhat rebellious, strong-minded daughters, Susanna and Judith. So we have information now about six women in Shakespeare's life, and I think the relations are so complex, so varying, so interesting, and he's in a way so reliant upon women, upon their stimulus, that I think the reality is much more interesting than the myth here.
Well, I certainly got that impression from your book, and I would direct our listeners to your book to get through a few of the other myths that have been created, especially recently with all the popularization of Shakespeare. What's your take on that? What's your feel about this growing new interest in Shakespeare? Do you think this is good or bad, or are you indifferent?
Well, I think it's wonderful. I love the film Shakespeare in Love. It laughs at itself. It's very witty. And I think we're interested in him right now because we share so many of his ideas, such as that family life is essentially important, that all things come out of that. And really, that's the basis even of great tragedies like Hamlet or King Lear. The family's right there at the center. His dislike, his distrust of supernationalism and wars, his real lack of honoring of the heroic and the romantic. He's romantic, of course, but he is essentially a gentle person, and we believe in Shakespeare's virtues. I think he's speaking to all of us. He's such an understander of human feelings that you open Shakespeare and you have a very close companion. So I think it's very right that he should be popularized right now.
Right, and that's, I think, the perfect note on which to end. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Very good. You've been listening to Park Honan, Emeritus Professor of English at the University of Leeds and the author of Shakespeare, A Life, published by Oxford University Press. And this is Talking History. Is he the Bard of Avon or the Fraud of Avon? Did Shakespeare really write the works of William Shakespeare, or was he a fake? Is it possible that the person about whom you've just heard in an interview wrote the 37 plays, 154 sonnets, and assorted poems we associate with Shakespeare's name? Or was it all the work of another person, like Christopher Marlowe, Francis Bacon, or Edward de Vere? Daniel Wright, literature professor at Concordia College in Oregon, thinks it was de Vere.
Who wrote the works of Shakespeare? Tradition tells us that the author was an ambitious merchant from provincial Warwickshire who was baptized Gulielmus Shaxburn. He was a man who never had a day's schooling, and still, when he yet was in his 20s, suddenly we are told, and are expected to believe, he began to publish the most erudite works of literature the world had ever or has ever seen. Poems and plays that are dense in their reliance upon classical antiquity, and continental source material that had not even been translated into English in the writer's day. Poems and plays that invoke the names and legends of over 400 classical figures from Greek and Roman mythology alone. Poems and plays that demonstrate the writer's easy familiarity with and competence in Latin, Italian, and French. So agile a facility in foreign languages, in fact, that the Shakespeare writer sometimes would compose whole sections of his work in another language, as we see when we read Henry V, for example. If the writer who called himself Shakespeare were this man, it is the most improbable tale in history. It is one that utterly defies explanation. In point of fact, however, this man from Stratford-upon-Avon, to whom no one in the literary world or anywhere ever wrote a letter, or more importantly received one, was not the author of the works that bear the pseudonymous name William Shakespeare. Their true author, in all likelihood, was Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford, cousin to the Queen and ward and son-in-law to her principal minister of state, William Cecil, Lord Burghley. He was a man that history knows as a writer who wrote in concealment, a nobleman acclaimed, in fact, the greatest pseudonymous writer of his age. Edward de Vere was a man nurtured in the arts of poetry and stagecraft from his youth. He was tutored by England's finest scholars and was multilingual, a fluent speaker and writer of Latin, Italian, and French. He was extensively traveled on the continent, especially in Italy, and owned a house in Venice. He was a member of the court, a visitor of other courts, such as the Court of Navarre. He held graduate degrees from Oxford University and Cambridge University, from both of which he graduated in his teens. He studied law at Gray's Inn, one of the inns of court, and one of the principal sites of theatrical performance in late 16th century London. Oxford was a patron of many writers, playwrights, and acting companies, and he held the lease to the Blackfriars Theatre, the principal private theatre in London. Oxford was an acclaimed poet and playwright declared the most excellent of all Elizabethan court poets by William Webb in 1586, hailed as the best for comedy by Francis Mears in 1598, and acknowledged by George Putnam in 1589, the best of those Elizabethan writers who were publishing without appending their own names to their works.
You've been listening to Daniel Wright, professor of literature at Concordia College in Oregon. This is Talking History. Could there be any doubt in your mind where we would send you this week as part of our site of the week? Hardly. And here to tell you all about Shakespeare Country is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Yes, Brian, where else would we send Talking History's listeners but to Stratford-upon-Avon, the birthplace of William Shakespeare? It is an area in England that is steeped in culture and history in the Warwickshire countryside. There are five 16th century houses in or near the area that are connected with William Shakespeare and feature rare period furnishings and domestic items. The most cherished historic place is the half-timbered house where Shakespeare was born in 1564. The second most famous is Anne Hathaway's house, where she lived before marrying Shakespeare in 1582. There is much to see and do while in Stratford-upon-Avon.
And finally, turning to our weekly segment, coming attractions, we have a recently opened museum exhibit and a forthcoming history symposium to recommend to you. First, Los Angeles' Skirball Cultural Center has begun displaying the original text of Nazi leader Adolf Hitler's infamous Nuremberg Laws. The museum has acquired the document on loan from the nearby Huntington Library, which made the surprise announcement recently that it possessed the documents, whose whereabouts were previously unknown. The laws, which were signed by Hitler in September 1935, aimed at purifying German blood, effectively defined Jews not just as a religious group, but as a separate alien race. And if you're interested in naval history, check out the 14th Annual Naval History Symposium to be held at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, September 23rd through the 25th. For more information, contact the Department of History at the U.S. Naval Academy. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week for our show on film and history. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions by email to talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian Lebeau. Thank you.